During the break, I was asked how to deal with past omissions, past errors. Can they ever be eradicated? Can one get over them? Can one wipe the slate clean? That's a very good question. It can be very hard to wipe the slate clean. Now, I think there are several ingredients that come to mind that one needs to factor in. I think one of the first ones and key ones that comes to mind is an acknowledgement that one has erred, made a mistake, that one has done something which one feels one shouldn't have done. Being very relational beings, it usually affects other, it's about the way other people have been affected by what we've done or not done. But I'm not aware of any arahants or saints in the room. They may be there. If they are, I bow to them. But most of us have a past, and it sort of leaves its traces, and the past is not necessarily always very wholesome. As I was saying earlier, before we had our break, the past echoes into the future and resonates into the future by happening now, and therefore affects how we speak, how we act, how we interact with others. So this acknowledgement has to happen on some level inside us first. And that can be a very difficult pill to swallow, because we inevitably, if we've been brought up well, have a part of us that believes we're okay, that we're good people, would like to believe that. And when something unpleasant comes up, an act or a deed or a word that we've colloquially misspoken, it's a nice excuse. It can really affect one's state of mind, one's mood, one's sense of feeling about oneself. We can get stuck in guilt trips. We can run ourselves down, have very negative self-view, and a lot of that is not very helpful. So the teaching that sort of refers to this, which I think is worth exploring a bit more deeply, is the concept or the one of part of the Eightfold Noble Path, which is right effort. Right effort is about preventing unwholesome states of mind from arising and overcoming them when they have arisen. And right effort also includes the arising, the encouraging of men of positive, wholesome mental states of mind and cultivating them. I think it's worth looking at this a bit more deeply. I'm not really privy to the refined discussions that may appear in the suttas and through real people who know the suttas and the teachings. But it seems to me that it really depends on the individual circumstances. But one has to get the balance right between the efforts to overcome or to develop and maintain. Because one can try and develop and maintain and ignore and pretend that things have always been okay or okay enough that one doesn't go back, one's in denial about what's happened. So that's a step in the right direction, but it's only a partial one. Coming face to face with one's shortcomings is a profoundly disturbing experience. Because whatever ideas we may have had about ourselves are shattered. And it's very difficult to function if one's self-image, quote unquote, is in some ways broken, and when we can't manage as a result of exposing ourselves to, my gosh, what have I done? How could I have done it? How many people I've hurt? So it's a sort of two-pronged approach, really. On the one level, we have to accept that this is what's happened. At the same time, somehow try and soften the impact that it has on us in terms of disabling us of doing anything about it. So having a positive approach to it as well, where the saying, or the, which I can call a saying, is that was then, this is now, trying to come into the present. But if this is now is overwhelmingly an expose, an x-ray of our shortcomings, then that can be very disabling, at which point it's best to back off. So ideally what we want is to have a self-regulating mechanism of insight and acceptance, a self-regulating way of maintaining some sense of balance, some sense of holding on to a reference point that does not condemn us to eternal damnation. We all hurt people at some point or another. It's inevitable. People have sensibilities, have perceptions, have expectations. And as the famous saying goes, we can't please everybody all the time. So sometimes we're inevitably going to upset people. So reviewing it, talking about it with somebody else can be a very helpful step to get an assessment on it. What do you think? In fact, even acknowledging that one maybe has done something wrong can be a big step in itself. Literature is full of stories of people burdened by guilt who end up taking their lives because they feel they're so worthless and are sort of beyond saving. But we are not beyond saving. We can save ourselves by an open acknowledgement and by humility, by accepting the truth of what's happened or the fact that it's happened and working with the feelings that it leaves us with. So the next step comes to my mind is there are two. There's the external, where we try and compensate for it. We say sorry. We acknowledge our fault, our shortcoming to the other person with sincerity, and be prepared. It takes courage to do that because, of course, the flack that one can get can be pretty powerful. You know, you're admitting it at last that you did it. Can be the accusation with a finger pointing. One has to say, yes, I did it. I did it. One has to surrender to the truth, not in some pathetic, obsequious way, but just say, yes, I did do that. I'm so, so sorry. It may be received, it may not be received. Often it can be said, how could you have done that? Well, one has to just acknowledge that one did it through one's shortcomings, one's failures of self-examination, of truthfulness. We all impinge and impact on other people and have an effect on them. And some of the effects that we have on them are not very nice. It can be very hurtful. And we obviously get feedback, get blowback from it. So on the external level, admitting it, if one is courageous enough to do it, is a good step generally. I'm not saying always, because sometimes it may not be the appropriate way or thing to do. It's using those five filters, those five stages of self-assessment. What are the criteria? I'll repeat them again because they're really worth remembering. Is it true? Is it helpful? Is it the right moment? Those are the key ingredients. And then, is it communicated kindly? And fifth one, is it done skillfully in a way that it reaches the other person? Those are the criteria to hold on. And I think they play a really critical part in assessing when to cultivate right effort and how to cultivate it. So it's really self-therapy. It's basically doing what is good for us in the best sense of the word, in the fuller picture. There is something quite disarming about a person who acknowledges a fault of some kind. Is disarming because we resonate with it. We can sense, my gosh, that must be awful. But sometimes it elicits condemnation. How could you? Statements like, how could you? How could you? Who are you? Why did you do that? Because the hurt is still too great. So how does this translate to what we're doing here, for instance, like sitting? What we do is the feelings of discomfort, the feelings of guilt, shame, arise as sensations in the body. Acknowledge them. Breathe in and breathe out and sit with them. If they become unbearable, then you get up, you go for a run, go for a swim, do something to distract the mind if it gets overwhelming. But in terms of sitting on the cushion, it transforms a chemical process taking place. It's an alchemical process of transformation of just sitting with the discomfort. Eventually, the impact of it, the strength of the feelings, will gradually diminish, and the nature of everything to diminish. We maintain it by coming back to it again and again, thinking about it, worrying about it, about the consequences. We just regurgitate the stuff again and again. So we maintain it that way, but eventually it'll fade. It'll fade if it's replaced by good intentions, by wholesome behavior, by wholesome thinking. The mind and the body are organisms in their own right, and things will come up that we have no control over. It can be negative thoughts, aggressive thoughts, lustful thoughts. Let them come. Don't engage with them. That's the best thing to do. And a cushion is the best place to observe that process, that alchemical process of material, mental formations, emotions arising in consciousness, sitting with them, breathing in, breathing out, and letting go. Letting go does not mean putting them away in a box and hoping they don't come back. It's letting them go, just letting them be. And it takes patience. Patience is one of the greatest virtues that we have, as mentioned by the Buddha himself. Patience is the greatest virtue. Why? Because it allows so-called time to do what it needs to do. The effects wear off because all phenomena, all conditions, including negative ones, eventually cease. And in fact, our judgment of what is good is also an opinion of you. But if we have some reference points in terms of ethical, moral behavior, as we have in the Buddhist tradition, certainly other traditions have it, they just do it a little bit more harshly, perhaps, and more as a rule, as a law, as opposed to an injunction or encouragement, the principle is the same. Do good, avoid evil, purify the mind. We purify the mind by doing what we do in the world in terms of how we react to other people. We purify the mind by our introspective practice, attentional training to what is happening, and developing a sense of distance. Distance does not mean pushing it around the corner and out of sight, just letting it fade and lose its significance, lose its physiological impact that it has on us. It's extraordinary that an event that happened then, yes, can affect us so much now. It's history, it's gone, yet somehow it lives on. And that living on means that the tendencies, the conditions that gave rise to whatever that error was, might still be knocking around, if only in our own habitual thinking and self-reflective process. So this is really profound internal work on oneself. People won't come and pat you on the back and say, well done, but you might get feedback by becoming a nicer, lighter, brighter, happier, more content person. And that way you share the benefits of accepting the way things are, the way you have behaved, without compartmentalizing it and making it into a fixed object that is immovable. And with time, it will fade. But of course, it can echo on. It can echo on. And I suspect it can, if one believes or accepts the teachings on rebirth, it probably can echo on into another life. Because some events are so significant to one's being that they leave an imprint in the psychic realm of existence and will reemerge in some other life. That's not to be believed in, but it's certainly how one can explain it to oneself. But accepting responsibility, the ability to respond to what one has experienced, is a key element. And what allows that? Being aware, being clear, accepting, being honest. Are we really honest with ourselves? We can say we are, but then we examine all those little nooks and crannies in our psyche and we see that we're often hiding behind pillars and not really acknowledging the truth. So, you know, the questions that were asked were very good. And why are they good? Because they pertain to 99.9% of us in this room, if not all, if almost certainly all of us. There's a saying which comes from a slightly different spiritual tradition, which says that sinners become saints, but all saints were once sinners, something on those lines. How do we learn? We learn through our mistakes. So cut yourself some slack if you're a self-punitive, guilt-ridden person. There were reasons why you did what you did, why I did what I did. They can be explained. They're not necessarily good, but if they're acknowledged and accepted, they can be changed. They don't have to be repeated. But sometimes we end up repeating those mistakes again and again and again. But each time, hopefully, a little bit more gets through to us that actually this is the right thing to be doing. There's a lovely poem, I've forgotten the author's name, it's a beautiful poem about holes in the road. that you end up going down a road which has no holes at the end of it. But initially, you keep on falling into the same hole again and again, blaming yourself, blaming others, until eventually you accept responsibility and walk down a different road and don't fall into the hole because there is no hole in the road. Now, what, of course, spiritual practice can do, it can give us access to more refined states of being. Because as we disengage from our thinking process and mental proliferation, as we get more and more absorbed in our meditative state, we experience what is referred to as samadhi, a blissful state of union, of oneness, which is very uplifting, very good experience to have. And even if one has transgressed and made errors in one's life, it's still possible, very much possible, to achieve a calmer state of mind. But the teachings warn that it's not the ultimate aim just to have a nice state of samadhi at the end of the road. That a state of samadhi is basically a purifying experience which shows one how one can be if one is unburdened by the past. Because our personality disengages, gets absorbed in the full attention that we pay to the sensations. That releases all our egoic patterns of behavior and experience and releases us. It allows energy which we're made of to flow freely through the body, which gives us blissful states of meditation. But the Buddhist teachings point quite clearly, they don't last. Why don't they last? Because they're a temporary, you could say, suppression of thoughts, of ideas, of history. All the thinking processes get subdued, at which point one is temporarily released. That has a very purifying effect on the body. One comes out feeling, well, maybe it's not so bad after all. Feeling a little bit happier about where we are. So it's good to practice. It's good to practice concentration practice, but remember that it is basically a form of practice that excludes things, whereas insight practice allows things in, allows us to be expansively aware. But we need to juggle them. In other words, know what to do when. And that's a lesson that we all have to learn in order to become our own teachers, our own regulators, our own affect regulators. Because as I said earlier, although it's not a term used in Buddhism, the process of individuation is a process of growth. Growth of what? Of awareness, of kindness, of breaking down this artificial barrier that we present around ourselves that in some ways we are separate from others and separate from the world. We are not separate. We are a manifestation of the world. We're an expression of the world. We're actually all as one massive, complex, infinitesimally, unbelievably factual fact of oneness, and we're all arising, it's all arising in awareness. So that's what the teaching of no self points to, that the self is a construct, nothing wrong with it unless you believe in it and think it's true. So we function as egos, as personalities with a sense of identity, very necessary. You can't not have an identity and live in the world safely in most cases, but it's quite extraordinary. Because when you actually do start losing your sense of identity, you suffer less fear, less anxiety, you're more content, more happy, and better things happen around you. There seems to be a causal relationship there for each one of us to explore. So I thought it was important to stress the fact that not to feel overly guilty, to accept responsibility, feel the shame. The shame is like a burning operation, but it basically burns out sense of guilt. And allows a flood of grace, flood of energy to suffuse the body and change one's relationship to oneself and to the world. So I think it's best that we start engaging in some way. Yes, do you have a question?
No, but I have a little story. Last week at a Quaker meeting where I go, I met a Quaker woman who's written a book on, I think it's entitled Friends Forever. And it's a collection of her letters to a man who was on death row.
Yes, death row.
Yes, in America, because he had killed three women or three girls, I'm not sure, some 30 years ago. He was still in prison, waiting to be executed. And he was in one of the states which was not pardoned by, well, the prisoners were not pardoned by Biden. So he's going to be murdered. And she told us the story. she describes how this man was transformed in the course of the 30, 25 or 30 or whatever years that he was in prison, how he transformed himself by being a murderer to become a highly spiritual and enlightened man. So she presented this book, and people were almost in tears in listening to her. Mm. It's an amazing story. It mm. just tallies with what you're saying.
Mm. Mm. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Mm. So his 30 years imprisonment gave him the opportunity to process the implications and consequences of it and purify himself. Very powerful. I see someone has raised their hand.
Hi, Nick. Hi, everyone. It's Tiffy here. Thank you very much for this. I just wanted to ask you what your thoughts were on this whole thing of doing wrong and seeking forgiveness or restoration on a kind of a community level, or even on a, I suppose, a national level. So obviously, we can probably all think of occasions when a whole community or a whole tribe, for want of a better word, or nation has been involved in some fairly grave wrongdoing against another nation, and the kind of the tidal waves that go on from that, and examples of when some kind of restoration has been sought. I'm particularly thinking of what, you know, some quite significant groups of Germans did following World War II and things like that. But connected with that also, you know, the way you were saying, well, you know, time kind of ebbs things away and ebbs mm-hmm. away the hurt and the pain and the guilt. But there are, you know, glaring examples of communities where things that happened 400 years ago, you know, are still marked and still people feel deep resentment about it. So mm. what I'm kind of asking myself is, us as a small community who might be a sign of a bigger community, you know, is there, I don't even know what the question is there some space in our envisioning of a more healed future mm. That we might be in this together as a community. Mm. And I suppose the final part of this rather garbled question, excuse me, is if we think about what we do as a generation and its impact on generations going forward. And obviously that's something that's on people's minds a lot, with a whole lot of things that are going on in this current globe. So the whole thing of restoration, I'm just searching for a way of thinking about it in a broader way as a community-based thing. Mm. Excuse me if that's very badly put. But...
No, thank you. I think I get what you're driving at. And it's a very, very profound question, because we inherit... I think in the Christian tradition, they speak about the sins of the fathers shall be visited upon the children. And I think that really is a dimension that we have to accept, that being born in a specific family, specific town, a specific region, specific country, comes as a with a package of all the identities and all the issues of that particular town, region, or family. The Buddhist emphasis is that we can't be responsible for what other people think or feel, but we can contribute to better things by leading our lives personally better, because essentially the collective is the sum total of individuals. Those individuals are individuals. We can do what we can to mitigate the effects of what the group has done, but we also, unfortunately, have to often suffer the consequences of what the group has done, of which we happen to be a part of. We don't really have much say that I'm aware of as to what race we're born into, what race, religion we're born into. But I do know that whatever race or religion one has been born into, how we behave in the moment with our conscience and with our words, our speech and actions is what we contribute or don't contribute to the whole. So what this is really accepting is the fact that change may happen, is happening, but whether it'll end up in a paradise on earth, highly unlikely. We don't have the givens for it. We have the potential as individuals, as smaller groups, but if we just look at the history of the world, we see that it's a relentless cycle of so-called samsara. It's part of existence, and we can't get away from it. The paradox of this process of existence is that all sorts of injustices take place, and I find it extraordinary how these injustices often lead to wonderful outcomes. That the suffering that people impose on one another actually can often elicit wonderful qualities. I find that a mystery because it doesn't fit in the neat package that good is rewarded by good and bad is rewarded by bad. It's really a very mixed picture. So I think the simplest, and what I certainly practice for myself, is to accept personal responsibility for my shortcomings, my strengths, cultivate the good ones, avoid the negative ones, and that's my contribution to the world. If I get prompted by all sorts of other conditions to get involved in some bigger issue, then I will do so. But I think it comes down to us accepting our role, our actions, our words, and taking responsibility for them. So I'm not sure that answers your question fully, but that's the response that comes to mind. My stepmother spent 4 years in Ravensbrück concentration camp together with her sisters and her mother, and they survived 4 years, which is no mean feat because concentration camps were not nice places, to put it mildly. Terrible place to be in. And yet after the war, her daughter, my stepsister, fell in love with a German. And I was astounded by my stepmother's acceptance of that and not condemning it, not in the slightest way. I spoke to her about it, and she felt no resentment. She was remarkable in that she was able to separate the individual from the collective. And I just take my hat off to her because, you know, just one day of a concentration camp would probably blow me away, let alone 4 years. My mother, similarly, she fought in the war. She didn't end up in a concentration camp. She managed to escape. But she had an interesting experience because she came to England with my father. She was Polish, and my father was English. And my father had rescued or had helped an inmate of a prisoner of war camp in Germany, where he had come across an English woman who had got caught up in the war by being in Germany at the beginning of the war. And anyhow, he helped her sort of get out of this prison. And she came to England and with her husband. And my mother went to visit them with my father. And I believe that I was in tow as well as a little boy. And on the mantelpiece in the household was a photograph of the statue of a Polish king. This is in Warsaw, and standing proudly in front of it was a German officer in his Wehrmacht unit, who happened to be the husband of this lady that my father had helped get out of prison. And my mother always said that she could never be in Germany without thinking, what did you do in the war? Because of the destruction that these people experienced. So the past sort of rolls on into the present in many ways for different people. But of course, very profound experiences, shocking experiences, leave a mark. And our psyches are just not designed sometimes to take these really painful blows, and they leave an effect which has to be worked through. So I like this approach that Buddhism says, you know, do what you can individually, find the support. It may take several lifetimes, and that's what the Eastern traditions do teach. They say that it could take many lifetimes to work out the so-called impurities. And the impurities, I think, has to be taken in terms as a word, not misleading. It's basically shortcomings, elements of ignorance, of not knowing better, habitual patterns which aren't very constructive, which are very self-indulgent. Those are sort of impurities, as it were, that need to be purified. And the purification isn't sort of going into a shower and coming out all clean and white. It's about what we're talking about, processing into consciousness, allowing all these states of mind into consciousness and allowing them to be transformed by being, quote unquote, exposed by consciousness. Because Consciousness is a healing process. If people are in denial, notice what happens when people are in denial. They lie, they mislead, they take advantage of each other because there's something is not being fully acknowledged. If we allow ourselves to be open to what's happening, it suddenly allows for a proper communication of energy where the feeling is one much of greater community, greater communion, greater harmony. Harmony is created by joined up feeling and thinking and not bearing ill will and grudges, because all they do is act as a poison. And we have to suffer the poison that other people are having to process or not process, but primarily work on our own. It all comes down to us. So every time, I quote this very often, every time we point a finger of he did this, you did this, there are always three fingers pointing back. What am I doing here? What have I done? What have I contributed? So point the finger by all means, but make sure that three fingers are pointing at yourself, because that's where all the work is. It's an internal job, not an external one. If the internal job is taken care of properly, it'll manifest in wonderful things on the outside. But there's a direct connection between the two. And all our practice is about linking these two, allowing so-called our consciousness, allowing awareness to absorb and include everything. And paradoxically, out of that comes true love, genuine sense of oneness. And out of that oneness comes goodness and compassion and kindness. And it also allows for equanimity, accepting the suffering of the world, because ignorance generates suffering. That's a fact. It's not about fighting it. It's about acknowledging that happens and finding skillful ways of mitigating it, of softening it, so that people learn, so that you learn, I learn from what we're experiencing for the benefit, not only of myself, because if it's for my benefit, it's automatically then for the benefit of others. Unless we try to hold on to it, at which point we're grasping and we're creating the causes of suffering.
Hello, thank you. So I've got a point to make. I wanted to ask you about this business of awareness. You know, if you're sitting in meditation, you've kind of touched on it in the Q&A here. If you're sitting in meditation and you realize, well, Jeannie, you know, I've lived a long life of unwholesome deeds and things I'm no proud of, and these things come to mind. What came to mind when you were speaking about all of this in the morning was, like, in the Zen tradition, I think it's the Platform Sutra and elsewhere, they talk about, you know, not sitting in with awareness of, like, oh, I'm a sinner, a long way off from enlightenment. You know, I'm just a humble layman, 1,000 lifetimes away from enlightenment, but rather to sit as Buddha, with the Buddha mind, the Buddha nature. These are just terms, obviously, but with that awareness, awareness almost is a moment of enlightenment. Mm-hmm. You know, because if I'm sitting there, this is something I just want a wee bit of clarity from your own Thai tradition of how you approach it. Because I think I've heard some of the Ajahns touching on this, Ajahn Sumedho maybe, of like awareness itself is like a moment of enlightenment. And that's what we're applying to our experience and recollection of our gunk, as it were.
But Andrew,
and just finish, is how does that tie in, you know, not to confuse apples and oranges with the Zen tradition of like Buddha nature, self is enlightened already. We just haven't woke up to it. Thank you.
That's okay. Thank you. You say you've got 1,000 lifetimes before you get enlightenment. We are all arising in enlightenment. We're just not aware of it, because enlightenment is awareness. So the moment of clarity that you describe actually is permanent. It's happening all the time, except we're so caught up in our thoughts, ideas about ourselves and others, opinions, views, feelings, sensations, decisions, likes, dislikes, that we lose sight of the fact that it's all happening all the time in one place. And it's not even a place, which is now. We are all in a field of awareness. We're all in a field of consciousness, which doesn't belong to anybody, has no beginning, has no end. So I don't know how that fits in with whatever Thai teachers you may have come across. All I speak from is an understanding that we are in awareness all of the time. It's the only thing that's real, actually, because everything else is changing. My words, your thoughts, your feelings, your perceptions, they're all coming and going, so are mine. But we have one constant in common, which is our awareness of what's happening. That is our Buddha nature. So we say, I won't get enlightened for another 20 years. There is no I to get enlightened. I is a construct. It's a belief system. It's a sense of identity. It's not what is true. And as such, it's an illusion. It's a very convincing one, and we have to acknowledge it and somehow navigate through all the manifestations of that illusion. But it is fundamentally an illusion. And that's what the teaching of not self is about. Teaching of not self is teaching us Buddha nature, to use that word, which isn't common in the Thai tradition, but we can refer to it because it's actually very much part of the Buddhist tradition. It's just not a term used in the original. I hope that goes some way to answering your question.
One last wee point while I've got the mic then. Sometimes I come across, I'm just getting back into, shall we say, the Buddhist, meditation, a strong Christian background. But I was into Buddhism before, years ago, the Vipassana tradition was very strong, the Goenka stuff. And but something I've heard a few people kind of whispering in my ear, or I've come across, is, you know, don't do too much too soon. Don't, if you do too much, you know, meditation, you get sensitive. And I just wonder, any thoughts on that from experience? Because, you know, like, we're sitting all day here today, and you do get sensitive from it, you know. And I work in a busy school where you don't really want to be sensitive, to be honest. but, you know, part and parcel of life, you don't want to be, you don't want to be ignorant either. I just wondered if there's any thoughts on that.
We suffer. We suffer sensitivity. But that's why sensitivity needs to be balanced by wholesome and supportive practices. Because one can suffer so much that one just becomes obsessed with suffering and other people suffering, wanting to rescue other people from suffering. We have to find the balance, right? Find the middle way. And that's our challenge. And each one of us, depending on our degree of sensitivity and the resources that we have, will end up with a different combination. But we have to somehow mitigate the suffering of this world. We can get so overwhelmed that we just give up and say, that's it, I can't take anymore. That's gone too far. But we can say, this is terrible, this is awful, and back off and process the suffering and what one can learn from it. What am I learning here? What is the teaching here? The teaching is that this world is full of suffering. It's everywhere. There's suffering in my life, there's suffering in other people's lives. There are collective sufferings on a scale and a magnitude that we have no conception of here in this relatively safe country where we're in. So it's dukkha. And we have to learn how to relate to it individually and employ whatever skills and abilities and support that we can gain. But thank you for asking the question. And
First off, just to say thank you so much. I don't know why you don't do this every week, because every time you speak, but not even joking. And I am one to joke, but you've got a gift. And I know what you do for a trade, but you should give it away a bit more, I think, in my opinion. But and also a little tip: next time you buy Ookie goods, get a DeWalt, much better than Bosch. But it was funny what you said, because my justification, I bought a lot of stolen stuff in my life, and I spoke to Ajahn Barry about it recently, about getting a bit more honest, and even down to digital downloading, because how does anyone know you've taken it if it doesn't exist, you know? And you know, and again, it's that ideal, not even the ideal, but it's just the way you said about being human and being decent. You know, you've really hit a nerve with me today, because it's so hard to admit what you've done. And even if you get a sense that it's wrong, you try and justify it with your past traumas, saying, well, if that teacher never touched me and did this, and that person never pulled a knife out or a gun out, I wouldn't have to be so violent in this world, you know. And and the question I've got today is, you said it earlier, or I interpreted it earlier, it's like the dissipation of energy. You see two ducks on a lake, and me in London this week trying to become a black cab driver, which again, I'm questioning, is that the right career for me? Because I get into a lot of negative interactions with people. Everyone's in a rush. I understand that everyone's trying to make a living, everyone's trying to get somewhere, and everyone got a sense of self. But when someone barks at me. I promise Agent Jack Barry I won't punch anyone anymore. So I've started that this year. We've done good this year. So I haven't hit anyone this year yet. But my habitual reaction to people being intimidating or argumentative or threatening is so intuitive. It's so instinctual. It's so spontaneous. Again, I'm taking from today, it might take a bit of time to, and I love what you said about really do the opposite, challenge it. And again, the only two things that sometimes stop me is one, be pride, because I'm from Southeast London and I'm Irish. We fight, that's what we do. And the other thing is fear. If I'm really honest with you, it's fear, because I've got a lot of pain in my body from bike accidents and life and wear and tear. And I've been diagnosed with a lot of arthritis recently. And it's the fear of someone physically hurting me, you know. And we was always told, where I'm from, again, not quite a Hampstead Heath teaching, but it's like you hit them first and you ask questions afterwards, you know. And my question is, and I'll shut up on this, the question is it better to risk being hit? Is it better to take a hit? Is it better to be insulted and be physically? Because to be honest with you, I'm at that age now where you could hit me. My pride ain't going to hurt too much anymore. But I don't want that horrible mental state when I sit on the mat, when I sit on the cushion. And like you said, it's like I've got to go through 10 ton of rubbish from my past before I can get to that point of being present. Mm-hmm. And there's not enough hours in a day for me to do that. And I'd like to spend the next couple of years lessening that past nonsense. Mm-hmm. So any thoughts on that one? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you, Colin, for sharing so much, because we can learn from sharing. It's always good to hear what other people experience. The first thing that comes to mind is do your best to avoid conflict in the first place. If you see conflict arising or beginning to germinate, back off. And where you might instinctively feel you want to say something to protect yourself, see if you can not say it or say something which lowers the temperature as opposed to increasing the temperature. We do build up a whole set of habits and patterns which we work out in the here and now, and this is what our practice is about. But describing, as you describe it, you know, there are situations which I'm sure could be dealt with in a way which reduces tension as opposed to adding tension. Inevitably, if you're mixing with people who do have that attitude, you will get bruised and bumped. But I'll say this, that fear is a real driver of behavior. And it's often for the right reason, but done in the wrong way. Because sometimes one can walk away through things to do with fear and not be doing the right thing. So fear has a role to play. You can say, thank fear, but don't let fear do the speaking. Don't let anger do the speaking. Acknowledge them and say, thank you, anger, you're trying to protect me. Fear, thank you, fear, for trying to protect me. But I have a bigger picture at stake now, which is my understanding that I've got to get through all this stuff somehow intact as best I can. And your fear and your anger is making it hard for me. You can actually have a dialogue with these parts. It's obviously very strong parts. They have very strong voices and they're very, very convincing. But just try and bring in a third voice and say, hold on, back off. I really don't want to get involved in this. And one can diffuse all sorts of violent situations by having a quiet response. I had a teacher once who was my sort of, guru for several years, my very first Chinese teacher, actually, in meditation. And we'd bought a place in Ealing, which was going to become the center. And the fact that the house had been abandoned for a long time, it attracted all sorts of characters. And when we were assessing what needed to be done in terms of a schedule of works and things like that, a group of real heavies came up and was sort of staring at us at a distance. Had no idea, but what it did, it induced fear, sort of, oh my gosh, what are these guys going to get up to? What do we do? Although we were training in Tai Chi and all sorts of Chinese martial arts, none of us felt particularly confident and wanted to actually test it out for real life in the street. And we were there collectively standing there. And my teacher just basically went straight to them, engaged them in a conversation. I have no idea what they talked about. But when he came back, they were all smiles. They were smiles. They left and everything was okay. That was a lesson that you don't walk away from fear. I've got some other instances that come to mind, but that makes too much storytelling. But the fact is that our attitude, our response to fear dictates what the outcome is. If we react with anger, with hatred, we're stuck in illusion or delusion, and what we do is we just add gunpowder to whatever mix is already there waiting to go off.
And last thing, where Mahatma Gandhi, from what I read, like the old Christian saying, turn the other cheek, he would actually encourage you to take the hit and just kind of have compassion, I guess, you know.
Well, be prepared to be hit.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you. And thank you for your utter transparency. It's so refreshing. It's ridiculous. Thank you.
I'll read the message. So the complete message of Braño is, good day, but let us not forget that the consciousness is one of the five parts of the so-called self. And on the path, there even all the feelings, sensations cease to be perceived. Exist in consciousness awareness in meditation. As I understand suttas, or at least what came out of this memory, basic question is, what is really mine and is worth to follow, to take, to grasp?
Right. Thank you, Lou. Thank you. And then thank you. Well, the first thing, when we speak about the senses, consciousness, we're talking about sense consciousness. So most of the comments made about consciousness in the suttas, as far as I understand, and certainly from what I've been taught, is that they refer to sense consciousness. Sense consciousness is one of the aggregates, one of the things that make up the heap, which we call a human being. And as such, they are transitory and imperfect. They're just transitory phenomena, which combined with the other elements make up a human being. The consciousness that I've been referring to, and Ajahn Sumedho refers to, or Longpo Sumedho and many other teachers, is a universal consciousness. I'm just using words here which are adjectives, because consciousness itself is beyond description, but it's just a temporary pointing to the state of awareness which contains sense consciousness but is not sense consciousness. We confuse the two because we're conscious, because we're aware, but we get so overwhelmed by our experience of sense consciousness that we get caught up with like and dislike, fame and infamy, all the things that arise in phenomena. So sense sensations, sense consciousness is phenomena. Awareness is not phenomena. It's not an object. It can't be measured, can't be judged. It's just the isness of things, which really have no separate identity. It includes everything. So hopefully that clarifies the use of the word consciousness as I have been using it, or awareness, and I use them interchangeably as a result of what I've read and heard and tried to make sense of myself. In terms of what is mine, well, if we accept that the five aggregates are just a mess of phenomena together, who's the owner of that phenomena? Is there an owner of that phenomena? The answer is no. That's what anatta is all about. There is no I. It's a temporary structure, construct, which develops out of the conditioning that we experience in our physical, emotional, and mental forms. There is no I, so that it doesn't belong to anybody. So that hopefully answers your second question. Of course, not. I hope that's made sense to everybody else. Yes.
Think about the whole thing about the owners of our karma, the heirs to our karma.
Yes, yes. That's a conventional use of the word self to identify that we do have a sense of responsibility, and its experience is a very personal one, but it has an ultimate object to go beyond it. So it's a conventional use of the word self. We do have a self, but it's a construct, and it operates in our everyday lives. We have our likes, our dislikes, our personality, quirks, and all the rest of it. They are there, but there's nothing fixed in them. There's nothing permanent, nothing eternal about them, nothing unchanging. They're constantly changing. You and I are not the same that we were 5 minutes ago, let alone 50 years ago. I'm assuming you're a little bit older than 50.
Can you rephrase it and say there is no permanent self?
You can do.
Because that may.
But it's a good thing to reflect on. What do they mean when they're talking about non-self? It's a sort of one of these, like a kungan or koan, you know, it's a sort of question, which the answer is, right. You know, one thinks that consciousness is the product of complex material phenomena. That's the materialistic perspective. But there is another reverse view that complex phenomena is a manifestation of consciousness, and that actually the primary state is consciousness out of which things arise, as opposed to the reverse way, that consciousness is something that is created by complex materials. So those are two points of view which on the surface, logically, can be argued for and against. So you need an element of sort of, so that's what it means when you suddenly switch and realize that consciousness is, in terms of awareness, is the primary. It's the primary state in which things appear and disappear. Yes.
One more question there, if I can. Amongst kind of Thai Forest teachers, there seems to be a bit of divide that those that teach about awareness almost like a substratum of existence.
Yes.
As opposed to those that say, well, no, it's...
Yeah.
It's not what they're talking about, as you're saying, everything is just, you know, the essential consciousness that is impermanent. There isn't any other awareness and consciousness. There seems to be a divide between different Thai Forest teachers.
A lot of it, I think, comes down to semantics. And ultimately, it comes down to what you make of it for yourself and test it out for yourself in terms of a reflective process and just reflecting on it. I mean, that's what philosophical inquiry is about. It's sort of, that makes sense, yes, but somehow it doesn't make sense in the context of this thing, which also makes sense. They seem to be contradictory. What is the answer? This is a genuine inquiry. It's a sort of don't know mind. A don't know mind is the one that discovers things. The mind that knows it all, has it all fixed, doesn't need to discover anything because it knows all the answers.
So when we say there is no self, what is it that we say that it's not born again? You know, we say that when we get to enlightenment, we are not born again. So what is it that is?
The complex of a belief system around an identity is not reborn, does not re-manifest. Because we are a complex set of volitional tendencies, of habits and patterns of behavior, which appear as an entity. And we sort of say, this is me and that's you. Well, on some level, it is true that we're breaking down one into bits and pieces, which appear to be separate and unique in some way. And they probably combinations will be unique. But there is no essential core self. So that's the Buddhist teaching on the soul. There is no such thing as an eternal soul. The closest we can get to it is, in terms of Buddhist teaching, is the fact that there is just awareness, at which point there is no identity. It's just the oneness, to put it again into words, which is all very terribly secondhand. Not good.
Then how does the, because we also say that there's bad karma and good karma.
Well, bad karma and good karma. What is karma? Karma is action. Good karma is good actions, actions which we could classify as wholesome, as upright, as sincere, as true, and all the rest of it. Whereas bad karma is something that is unwholesome, unhelpful, and does not lead towards enlightenment. All Buddhist teachings are primarily concerned about pointing us to liberation from suffering. Liberation from suffering means seeing into the nature of existence and knowing what's what, and in that process, losing one's attachment to an individual sense of identity. It doesn't mean we don't have an identity, but the identity is a temporary one, a transient one. It's a collection. We come together as a whole, but then you speak to an old person as their brain's going, and they're gaga, they've gone. Where is that person who wrote all those wonderful books or spoke so nicely? Just a mass of flesh rotting and then eventually disintegrating. The interesting thing is, what is reborn? I think that's an interesting one. Well, I would argue that it's volitional tendencies which have an energy to them. And they basically will find an expression in the physical level of existence. So the tendencies, the habits that we develop, yes, will carry on manifesting in some form or other, even when the body that is in which it is manifesting falls apart. But again, Buddhism does not say you've got to believe in it. It's just saying that for you to consider. All the teachings are for consideration. And in fact, many of the talks that we hear in the temple, in the monastery, are for your consideration. For you to consider. Don't accept it as blind truth. Don't accept what I'm saying as blind truth. But that's interesting. It sounds very convincing. He speaks well, but is it true? You've got to find out whether it's true.
I always think of it as like a coming together of energy as like, I mean, I know there's no sound, but it is like a grouping of energy that sort of goes on and on, which is sort of changed by what we...
Yeah, it's a nice way of seeing it as a bundle of, we're a bundle of energy manifesting in very complex form, most complex that we're aware of, certainly in this part of the universe, although there may be other realms that we're not aware of. But yeah, that's another way of putting it. But what is important is the essential truth of that factor of existence of impermanent. It's impermanent. There's nothing permanent there. There is a sense of continuity because it keeps on metamorphosing and changing as it manifests, but it's a changing set of phenomena which comes into being and ceases and ceases.
We see it as being ceased, but it continues in a different form.
Well, when you say it continues, the patterns continue manifesting in complex ways and interact with other patterns. Exactly. So you know, I can't say definitely what happens after death. I have no idea. But it's emerged. Things happen. I have no idea.
Yeah, we don't know. But
some people say they do.
Continues in a different form that we, which we...
Yes, as long as it's not seen as a permanent it.
My other question, maybe, since we talked a lot about, you know, thinking about what we've done in the past, good and the bad.
Yes.
Let's say if it's about the bad, how do you also find that space for self-compassion?
Well, the question is, if we accept that we're... I'm trying to repeat for the benefit of people who maybe can't hear your question. How do we find space and compassion for us knowing that we've done bad?
Yes. And the labeling can be quite strong. The
labeling, question it. Is it true? Are you sure? You know, are you sure that that's true? Do you know that for a fact? You have a feeling, but what you know about feelings is that they come and go. Judgments come and go. Opinions come and go. Maybe I'm not so bad. Just open up, put a question mark over it. Yeah. Any assumption and any conclusion we come to, always have a question mark over it. Yeah. Just say, well, that's what it appears to be like. The only thing you're certain of is that you're having an experience. That's the clue.
Yeah. Roman?
Oh, hello. First of all, can I just apologise that I shall have to leave fairly shortly for family reasons. But so the question I'd like to ask is, because I'm so impressed by what you're saying, and I've actually got a lot of strong interest in philosophy. Have you ever thought about writing a book?
No, the truth is, I have thought of it, but there's so many wonderful books around. I thought, there's too many books in the world. What is wanted is practice. But yeah, but thank you for the suggestion. It's been made before, but my life doesn't allow me to do it. Too busy, but thank you.
I shall just have to try and take careful notes then. Thank you.
Yes, and also there is a question on the chat from Peter. I don't have a working microphone, so could you ask, with the picture of devastation in Gaza, there is a clash of identities between Palestinian and Israeli. Should the Palestinians try to protect their self-identity and the Israelis and Americans respect it with a separate state?
I think that's a question that many people are asking. The only answer that I can really offer is that what we're witnessing in the Middle East is deeply saddening, deeply disturbing, deeply upsetting, and it all comes down to injustices being experienced by one side and then by the other, and it's like an endless game of ping-pong. There's a Jamaican saying that my wife quotes me, what starts bad in the morning ends up bad at night. The whole history of that part of the world is one history of conflict, of reaction and reaction. What I do know is that we have to take responsibility for our individual response and see what the effect these events are having on our consciousness. It's shocking because, as we were speaking earlier about both the collective and the individual responsibility, collectively we have been, I think, colluding with what's been going on there, whether it be right or wrong. We've been colluding by allowing it to happen. What's happening is absolutely terrible. It's a disrespect for life. It's breaking virtually every precept that one can think of. And it's not a good thing to be happening. And it shouldn't be supported. If I'm going to say any shoulds, that's the one thing. The violence there, the injustices should not be supported because they're wrong. That's my personal take. But I'm not going to pass a comment about what the Israelis and Palestinians are. What I can say is that I understand why the 6th of October, took place. And I understand what's happening there as to why it's happening. But I'm certainly not in agreement with any of it. It's just the wrong way to go about resolving a problem. And what we see there is can only be dealt with a combination of compassion arising out of the shock and horror of the suffering, and equanimity. Equanimity doesn't mean happy-clappy, that it doesn't matter. What we're witnessing is samsara at work. We're witnessing ignorance at work, of fear, of anxiety. Everybody's fighting for their life at the expense of others. We have to take an individual decision as to how to respond. So I can't give you an answer to the question as you have framed it.
Nick, there is a second comment and question from Branio. Thank you, Nick, and others. Do we have any reference in the suttas to distinguish the two consciousness, sense and ultimate? Because if I think about dependent origination stages, ignorance, formations, consciousness, name, mentality, and form, body, six senses, it sounds to me like it was created something more than it is described, or another Mara's hook.
Well, one can get lost in philosophical debate about the meaning of different terms, and I don't want to do that. I'd suggest that I missed the name of the questioner to listen to some talks by Ajahn Sumedho and also look in the chanting book where it refers to a state of consciousness which transcends the normal understanding of sense consciousness. So there isn't much there, I don't think, in the suttas as far as I know, but I'm no expert on the suttas. But I know it's a teaching that speaks to me and speaks to many, and it's taught by people whom I respect and revere as teachers. But personally, I have no doubt about the truth of it because we're experiencing it all the time. And I think what we're in the dependent origination, we're seeing the psychological building blocks of what we call a personality. So I think there is truth in that. There's definitely one way of interpreting it, but I think there is another dimension to consciousness as awareness, as pure awareness, which is inferred and referred to in a few places. But I can't point you to the exact ones because I'm no Pali scholar.
Thank you, Nick. It's just been really, wow. It's like been really, I'm going to use the word refreshing, but to hear, you know, just how we can apply, you know, the Dharma really. I guess like there's two parts to my question. I guess I can get a bit into my head and sort of what is suffering, what is not suffering, etc. And you mentioned that, you know, people often go through very challenging times, you know, with very traumatic stuff in society, etc. I know my parents had a tricky time post World War II. So any thoughts on sort of you know, dismissing things are they impermanent, or it's just there's no self and all that. is there any way to sort of like be more embodied about it, you know, not just go into my head and sort of like, oh, you know, try to minimize things? I don't know if that question makes sense or not. No.
I'm trying to doing the best I can. If you have a question, you can inquire into who's asking the question, where's the question come from, or why am I having a question? You're probably having a feeling or a sensation somewhere. So if you notice yourself questioning, you recognize it. Well, there's a recognition of questioning. Okay, what's my strategy for questioning? Go to the body, go to the sensations, because you can go on forever in speculating. It's called mental proliferation. And it doesn't lead to anything constructive. It's just a repetitive cyclical thinking. So you want to go out of the head and into the body. And then that'll allow the more evolved parts of our being to manifest. Otherwise, you just get caught up in mental proliferation.
So basically, did you just say, ask who's asking the question?
Is that... You can do. I'm just, it's just one way of sort of cutting through.
Asking the question. And
what am I doing about this? Here I am thinking, I'm thinking. All right. What's the injunction? Stop thinking. How do I stop thinking? Go to the sensations. The thinking might continue, but at least you're drawing attention away from the thoughts and the contents of the thoughts and just going to the sensations. And then the mind will say, this is dead boring. Much more interesting to start thinking about things. Well, if you notice that, you can say, what am I doing? I'm going away from the boring to something that is more stimulating, but it's just thinking. Go back to the body. So thank you for the question, Jonathan.
And I guess, and what about if there's examining things and then there's, I guess, for example, if, you know, I'm not doing it now, but I was watching so much news about North America last year, and I've chosen not to do that. But there is a voice that wants me to do things that, you know, flattens emotions, flatten things out. I'm just trying to work out how to apply what we're learning here to, you know, when that something perhaps unskillful or wholesome comes up, how can I sort of catch that, I guess?
Well, if you're noticing it, you're already at the point of catching it.
And I guess then I guess it's about generally raising awareness, because that's often when I don't notice it, and then it's like, so
exactly. When you get caught up in it, you will soon recognize that you're caught up in it, at which time you try and extricate yourself from it.